This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iranians across the nation mourn the victims of the Wednesday terrorist attack in Kerma. In Israel, the U.S. genocidal war on Gaza is still raging. 22,400 Palestinians have so far been killed, mostly women and children. Several Persian Gulf states strongly condemn comments by far-right Israeli ministers who call for the immigration of Gaza's residents to other countries. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. Thousands of mourners have gathered at the Congregational Prayer Site in the Iranian city of Kerman to bid farewell to victims of the Wednesday terrorist attack. People from all walks of life attended a funeral ceremony to offer condolences to the families of the victims. And mourners called on authorities to bring perpetrators of the deadly explosions to justice. They also condemned a deadly attack that killed more than 80 people and injured some 280 others. Majority of those killed were women and children.
On January the 3rd, 2024, twin terrorist explosions hit an event in the Iranian city of Kerman, marking the fourth anniversary of the assassination of senior Iranian commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The two explosions occurred minutes apart at two different locations packed with civilians. Some of the injured recount the horror that they've been through.
I think it was 3 o'clock when the explosion happened. People were running toward me. I saw several injured lying on the ground. I was scared. It was very awful. The air was dusty. I really don't want to remember that moment again.
There was an explosion that caused a commotion, and suddenly there was a second blast that made people more afraid. Shrapnel could be seen, and people were falling on each other. I can't describe. I can only say that it was a terrible moment.
The terrorist attacks have drawn strong condemnation from Iran, other countries, and international bodies, including the United Nations. The Security Council has called it a reprehensible act whose perpetrators should be held to account. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has vowed those behind the cowardly terrorist bombings cannot get away with their crime.
This flood of people that poured towards the grave of Haj Qasem these days, you come to scare the people within your criminal act. You're not strong enough to face the resistance. Your power has lost its effectiveness against the forces of resistance. Now you're targeting innocent people? Know that you will pay a heavy price for this horrible crime.
Meanwhile, the drama took a new twist when the Daesh terrorist group claimed responsibility for the bombings. Some experts argued that the terrorist attacks bore all the hallmarks of an Israeli operation rather than one by Daesh.
Whoever is behind it, and I think we can assume who that is, that this has the United States and Israel written all over it.
Some Iranian media also cast doubt over Daesh being behind the attacks, as the terrorist group has a different modus operandi. These media believe the Daesh statement was in fact drawn up by the Israeli regime. They say this proves Israel is really scared of the consequences of its criminal act and that Daesh is a tool in the hands of the Tel Aviv regime. But whoever behind the deadly terrorist act, one thing is certain. And that is, the terrorists have failed to achieve their objectives by killing innocent civilians.
Iranian mourners have called for unity as they condemn the terrorists and their supporters for committing such heinous crimes.
Iran's enemies should be aware that terrorist attacks will not undermine the unwavering support of the people for their government. Taking the lives of innocent civilians is a despicable act of cowardice. We will stand united with the government.
My wife and I were at the scene when the explosion occurred. There was thick smoke. I saw many bodies. Many people had fallen in the blast, including many women and children.
These are the final efforts of the arrogant enemy, especially the usurping, child-killing and criminal Zionist regime, which is spending its last days with God's help. And we will definitely be steadfast in defending Islam, the revolution and the way of martyrs. We hope to continue the way of martyrs. They do not reach the result in the path they follow. The last moments of their lives are on earth.
My neighbor's son and some of my relatives were killed in the explosion, including a 7-year-old child who was one of my relatives. All parents can understand my sorrow. Humans should have conscience and humanity. But do these terrorists have any humanity? Their actions are even more inhumane than those of animals.
Journalist and activist Habiba Jaghouri earlier joined us with her take on the role of the Israeli regime in the terrorist attack in the Iranian city of Kerman.
The way that Daesh, ISIS, claimed responsibility for this attack was very, very suspicious. It's so important to use critical thinking skills here and evaluate how previously ISIS have claimed attacks, claimed responsibility for these attacks, and these do not match up to Kerman's attack that happened yesterday. It's very important to realize also which entity and which organization, which state has something to gain from conducting such a terrorist attack on Kerman. Given the history of Major General Qasem Soleimani, who he is and what he did for the region, who his enemies were, I think it's obvious that the country that has set a bomb off in Beirut, Baghdad, Damascus, and is currently committing a genocide in Gaza right now, mass attacks on the West Bank, I think that very, very fair to say and speculate that Israel is very largely responsible for the attacks in Kerman. It's absolutely testimony that around the country, not just in the city of Kerman, people condemned it straight away by acknowledging the U.S. and Israel as the biggest warmongers, the biggest perpetrators of terrorism across the globe. If anything, these people should be applauded. These people should be given a worldwide platform to express their grief, to express their rage, and also they have absolute right to ask every single human rights organization, ask the UN to conduct an investigation and who was truly behind this attack.
U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza enters now its fourth month as the regime in Tel Aviv continues pounding the blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery fire. In the latest development, an Israeli airstrike targeted European hospital in Khan Yunis to the south of Gaza, killing at least one Palestinian and injuring several others. In the Nusayra refugee camp in central Gaza, five Palestinians were killed and several injured as Israeli forces targeted a vehicle. The death toll in Gaza has already surpassed 22,400, mostly women and children, since October 7th. More than 57,000 have also been injured. And according to the UN estimates, a deadly onslaught has also displaced nearly 2 million Gazans.
There are now nearly 1.9 million displaced across the Gaza Strip. Among them are 1.4 million in 155 shelter centers or UNRWA schools, and there are around 500,000 in other locations.
Abu Hassan added most Gazans are being pushed to Rafah, which can only accommodate about 250,000 Palestinians. He said this is while there are around 1.3 million people in Rafah living in dire conditions. The UNRWA official warned the health and environmental conditions are facing major collapse. This as the Gaza health sector has been largely under Israeli relentless bombardment since the beginning days of the war. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society has urged the international community's intervention to protect the Al-Amal Hospital, as well as its premises and staff. And now we're going to swing over to Deir al-Balah in the besieged Gaza Strip. We are joined by Moti Abu Musabe for an update. Hello, Moti. Hope you're safe out there. What can you tell us on the ground?
Yes, actually, more Palestinian dead bodies were extracted from the destroyed houses targeted yesterday in Al-Zawaida and Al-Maghazi refugee camps. So we are talking about continuous Palestinian dead bodies are extracted, these movements. In the same context, we are talking about continuous and constant Israeli bombardments resulted in from the continuous Israeli shelling, reaching and targeting the central area of Gaza, particularly Al-Maghazi refugee camp and Deir el-Balah city, as we are standing right now. In the meantime, the fierce gunfight erupted between the Palestinian resistance fighters and the Israeli occupation forces in the eastern parts of Deir el-Balah city and Al-Maghazi refugee camp, where explosions were heard over the last couple of hours, and many Israeli helicopters were recalled in order to assist the Israeli occupation on the ground, which means that those gunfights erupted were very drastic, and the Palestinian resistance till this moment are able to fight back against the Israeli occupation forces relentlessly. And meanwhile, these moments, actually, the Israeli bombardments are still continued and maintained against Khan Yunis city. Multiple and several residential buildings were targeted by the Israeli warplanes, leaving dozens of the Palestinian casualties and the Palestinian civilians dead and injured. So we are talking about continuous Israeli bombardments, continuous constant Israeli shelling, reaching all areas of Gaza Strip, particularly the central area and Khan Yunis city, these moments. And in the same time, we can say that the humanitarian conditions are still deteriorating with the time, as the people here and Gaza Strip till this moment have no access to the basic humanitarian needs and the supplies allowed to enter from Rafah crossing into Gaza Strip. The people are still suffering and grappling to cope with this dire conditions and this kind of unprecedented situation. We are talking about a catastrophic situation in terms of lacking any access to the food, water, and clothes, and any basic humanitarian needs. So this is the current situation so far.
And Moti, at this point, the most concentration of the invading occupation forces, where are they, what part of Gaza are they fighting with the most right now with resistance fighters?
Yes, actually, the gunfight and the resistance actions are completely intensified these moments in the central area of Gaza Strip, particularly at the entrance of Al-Maghazi refugee camp on Salah al-Din Street and the eastern parts of Deir el-Balah city and in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city. And these areas actually are witnessing these moments, a drastic and fierce gunfight between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces. Apparently, the Israeli occupation forces still this moment have no access to enter those areas. They are unable to overcome the Palestinian resistance and the defense lines of the Palestinian resistance over those areas.
Thank you, Moti. Stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Moti Abu Musaba, they're joining us from Deir al-Balah, the besieged Gaza Strip. Persian Gulf nations join a chorus of global condemnation against comments by Israeli officials calling for the immigration of Gaza's residents and reestablishment of Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territory. Saudi Arabia categorically denounced and rejected the remarks made by far-right Israeli ministers Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. Riyadh called on the international community to act against Israel's persistent violation of international law. Qatar also condemned in the strongest terms Israel's policy of collective punishment and forced displacement. UAE also categorically decried and rejected the extremist remarks. Kuwait warned against such a plan as well. The U.S., France, and the European Union have all denounced the comments. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk emphasized international law prohibits the transfer of protected persons within or deportation from an occupied territory. Meanwhile, Palestinians trapped in the besieged Gaza Strip are desperately struggling with severe scarcity of daily necessities, and they're facing water shortages and lack of clean sanitation. So let's take a listen to some of them talk about their dire situation.
As you can see, we have children with us, but there are no shelters. We have women and children, but there is no food, no water, no daily necessities. What we drink is salty groundwater. There are patients with kidney diseases and pregnant women, but we don't have nursery rooms and professional doctors. Babies don't have milk. Please look at us in Gaza. Our women, children, and elderly are suffering. Think about the dead and the injured we've been forced to leave behind.
There's a water shortage. As you can see, there is no water. People stand in line and go around the region to look for any source of water for their children. We have so many problems. In the camp inside, we have no water, no service or care, no hygiene. Regarding the face masks, it caused a lot of sickness for children and elderly that have health problems. And as you can see on the streets, there are many face masks everywhere, and there is no municipality to take care of people. It's spreading everywhere, and even insects invaded the houses and the streets.
Another Palestinian has been killed in fresh attacks on Palestinian cities in the occupied West Bank. A 17-year-old was shot dead by Israeli forces in the West Bank city of Al-Khalil. The Israeli military forces also raided several areas in Nablus, Ramallah, and Al-Khalil. Fierce clashes erupted between Israeli troops and Palestinian fighters in Nablus city. The Palestinian Red Crescent has said Israelis are targeting ambulances in the two cities and injuring a number of medics. IOF troops have killed over 300 Palestinians and nabbed over 5,000 since the 7th of October, concurrent with the regime's onslaught on Gaza. Tel Aviv claims crackdown in the West Bank aims to target armed resistance, while they're also targeting civilians and medics. Masses of Yemeni people have taken to the streets of Sada'a to show support for Palestine. Demonstrators warned Israel and its allies about the repercussions of continuing the genocidal war on Gaza. They chanted slogans against the occupiers and called for immediate ceasefire in the besieged enclave. Meanwhile, large numbers of demonstrators rallied in Hodeidah, cautioning the U.S. and other Western states about the consequences of attacking Yemeni fighters. In recent months, Yemeni armed forces have succeeded in disrupting the sailing of Israeli ships or Israel-bound vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas, including the Bab al-Mandab Strait. The Yemenis insist they will press ahead with their anti-Israel operations to push for the delivery of humanitarian aid into Gaza residents. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime has a long history of systematically undermining the health rights of Palestinians and utilizing destructive tactics to achieve its ends. The Zionist regime practices medical apartheid. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, the Fourth Geneva Convention obligates an occupying power to ensure that proper medical supplies are provided and that hospitals and health services are maintained in the territory under occupation. The Zionist regime is doing the exact opposite. It is subjecting healthcare to collective punishment so that Palestinians are tortured, displaced, and killed. The Zionist regime has a long history of systematically undermining the health rights of Palestinians and utilizing destructive tactics to achieve its ends. The Zionist regime practices medical apartheid. Though not defined formally in international human rights law, the term medical apartheid has been used to describe similar situations of pervasive segregation and discrimination in healthcare based on race and characterized by stark inequalities in healthcare accessibility, availability, and quality. The Zionist regime has been hampering the development of, destroying, and openly targeting the Palestinian healthcare system. The system was built and supported mainly by international donors. Strategically, the Zionist regime made Palestinian healthcare dependent on aid. Over the years, Israel has been attacking health facilities, medical workers, and ambulances in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Since October 7th, the Zionist regime has repeatedly attacked hospitals and medical centers in order to push people out of Gaza. It has caused a scarcity of medical supplies, fuel, and necessities such as food and water for the same purpose. The estimated 800,000 people who remained in northern Gaza after the Zionist regime's evacuation orders have been left without any health care, apart from some failed medical points that cannot provide anything beyond first aid. Hospitals have been put out of service after the Zionist regime attacked them, threatening the lives of patients, displaced people, and healthcare personnel. The same steps are being taken in southern Gaza. The Zionist regime is now carrying out ethnic cleansing against Palestinians by wiping out the basics of life in the south. That includes healthcare infrastructure. The scale of human losses is enormous. Survivors have been left with no choice but an exodus. The underlying problems, the development and destruction of healthcare, started a long time before October 7th. For almost 17 years, the blockade has meant that Gaza's healthcare system cannot function properly. The health ministry has been unable to provide sustainable services. The Zionist regime has deliberately restricted access to medicines and essential equipment such as medical imaging devices. Israel has prevented the entry of X-ray and other scanning machines and spare parts based on claims that they can be used both for civilian and military purposes. By February 2022, Israel had approved only 30 out of 120 requests submitted by the Palestinian Authority in 2021 for the entry of such equipment into Gaza. Under siege, Gaza has not been able to devote the resources needed for training and recruiting specialized staff. That has undermined the capacity of hospitals to offer specialized services such as oncology, nephrology, cardiology, and advanced surgeries. Moreover, patients who require specialized care frequently cannot access it outside Gaza. Restrictions on movement have condemned many to deaths that were preventable. In 2021 alone, more than 36% of applications for permits to receive treatment outside Gaza were either refused or left unanswered. According to the Fourth Geneva Convention, hospitals, clinics, ambulances, and their staff are protected at all times, so They can freely treat the wounded and sick. Attacks against them are war crimes and violations of international law. Over the years, the Zionist regime has faced no consequences for its attacks. Since October 7th, the Zionist regime has attacked more than 140 health institutions, putting 23 hospitals and 53 medical centers out of service. The Zionist regime has killed more than 300 healthcare workers, some with a huge amount of experience. Many have been attacked at home with their families or while on duty. Such attacks are clearly assassinations. Their aim is to deprive Gazans of any hope of being saved or treated. The ground invasion enabled the Zionist regime's forces to meticulously select their targets among medical staff after besieging hospitals or blocking the roads used by ambulances. The Zionist regime has abducted approximately 100 healthcare workers. They include Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, director of Ashifa, Gaza's largest hospital, and Dr. Akram Hussein, head of the surgery department at Gaza's Indonesian hospital. Worsened by the ground invasion, the obstruction of ambulances is becoming a more commonly practiced tool of medical apartheid. The wounded are left to bleed to death without help. In addition to this overt destruction, the Zionist regime has engineered a public health crisis. Israel's actions have led to the rapid spread of illnesses such as diarrhea, scabies, lice, chickenpox, skin rash, hepatitis A, and upper respiratory infections. The disruption of vaccination programs, overcrowding at shelters, and winter weather exacerbate the problems. Similarly, the tightening of blockade since the war began, and particularly the restrictions on the entry of essential medical supplies, has led to a surge in deaths that could have been prevented. Until now, more than 9,000 people are reported to have died during the war because hospitals lacked resources and supplies and could not conduct operations. These include patients who died from infections and birth in humane circumstances. They also include patients with chronic diseases who have not been able to find medicines. The effects of continuous bombardment on mental health is just as profound as the physical effects. Yet, mental health services remain grossly inadequate, exacerbating the suffering. According to reports, more than 60% of homes in Gaza have been destroyed in the current war. Universities, factories, governmental buildings, and hospitals have been attacked. All this violence makes it impossible to provide the services necessary for life and impacts the livelihoods and mental health of Gaza's people. The destruction and displacement which the Zionist regime is causing appears to be a strategic move to make Gaza unlivable. Gazans are being pushed to leave Gaza. This approach is reminiscent of ethnic cleansing, as UN experts have noted. Urgent action is imperative to end the war, lift the blockade, and ensure the free flow of essential supplies and skilled professionals to Gaza. Rebuilding healthcare infrastructure and giving comprehensive support are crucial steps to mitigate the devastating effect of the Zionist regime's war on Gaza.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavit Halfway. In Iran, people have marked the fourth assassination anniversary of the anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. And while this honorable event was taking place, a horrible terrorist incident has occurred here in the Islamic Republic, claiming the lives of many Iranians who are paying homage to him. Why did this terrorist incident take place at this time? Was it, to use Iran's interior minister's words, detract Iranians' love and honor for the anti-terror icon, Qasem Soleimani? Also, in terms of this incident, terrorist incident, was it to use a means to detract from the way that Iranians were paying respect to him? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the legacy of this prominent figure in Iran's history, which revitalized the axis of resistance in the region, a basis for the courageous fight the resistance fighters are waging against the Israeli regime forces in the Gaza Strip. And this is why Iran's president has said that the resistance groups will make Israel pay a heavy price for its terrorist act. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Sayed Mohammad Marandi, university professor and political analyst, joins us from Tehran. Also joining us is Sayed Mostafa Hoshesh, political analyst from Tehran. Welcome to you both. My condolences obviously go out on this sad occasion that was meant to honor the late Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, but obviously an analysis needs to be put into the picture, and if you could put things into context for us. First, I think it's worth remembering, and I'll start with you, Sayed Mohammad Marandi, the reasoning that was given back when the targeted assassination took place by the U.S. on Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo saying that there was imminent attacks that he had planned, which we understand obviously is a false premise. Maybe you can recount to us why that type of thinking went into play as the basis for what was said at the time was the assassination of Haj Qasem Soleimani.
Well, if an imminent attack was about to take place, the last place where he would be in Baghdad. Obviously, that's nonsense. And we also recall that the Iraqi prime minister at that time, he said very specifically that General Soleimani came to Iraq to visit me because he had received a letter from the Saudi crown prince and they wanted to discuss rapprochement. So after midnight, General Soleimani, when he arrived in Baghdad from Damascus, he was leaving the airport with his colleagues and with Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was leading the fight against ISIS in Iraq, the Iraqi commander. And he was to meet the prime minister at 8 a.m., if I'm not mistaken, in the morning, hours later. And that's when the Americans killed him. And obviously, the Americans had information about the intention of General Soleimani to meet the prime minister and to discuss the peace and rapprochement with Saudi Arabia, because the Americans are everywhere in Iraq. And therefore, that's all nonsense. The Americans wanted revenge because they had been humiliated by the resistance, whether in Syria, where the Americans had supported extremist groups, they had supported ISIS, they had supported al-Qaeda, one example is the email from February the 12th, 2012, from Jake Sullivan to Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State at that time, and Jake Sullivan, who is now the National Security Advisor of Biden. In that email, and everyone can find this online, he said, al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. This is in early 2012. And we know that later on, ISIS, which was a part of al-Qaeda, broke away from al-Qaeda. So they were supporting these extremist groups. The defeat of ISIS, the defeat of al-Qaeda, was something that angered the United States. It angered Trump, both their defeat in Syria and Iraq, and the Americans were angry that it created a bond, a strong bond between the Iranian people and the Iraqi people, and they got their revenge. But in my opinion, the Americans miscalculated because it mobilized the Iranian nation. Millions of people came to the streets to commemorate, in Tehran alone, to commemorate the martyrdom of General Soleimani.
Now, this is a point that I'd like to take up with you, Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh. The fact that you have, I believe one of our guests actually said this, which I'm going to ask you, that this terrorist incident that has now taken place in the Islamic Republic, he said that the U.S. and Israel actually fear Haji Qasem Soleimani's death even more now that he's dead than alive, because the legacy that he left behind and what he stood for in terms of the anti-terror icon is an inspiration for example, resistance groups to continue this fight that they're having in terms of the imperialist powers like the U.S. And therefore, that aspect of it is what stands out right now. Do you think that that is a valid perspective and what this represents in this case?
Hello, and thanks for having me, and hello to Dr. Marandi. Well, that's true, actually. Qasem Soleimani was a unique commander. When he, before he they martyred him, he had already told friends in Quds Force as well as in Lebanon that he had planned the future of the resistance against the Americans and Israelis for the next years to come. And that's true. It's no secret. Everyone knows that General Soleimani, you know, provided logistical backup and everything to the resistance groups, including Hamas and others all across the region. And I do believe not much, but all of the things that we see these days is the product of Qasem Soleimani. And he is even more frightening to the Americans and Israelis these days, even more than before. The kind of strategy that he started over 20 years ago, some 20-something years ago, still continues. Let's remember that back in 2001, the United States invaded Afghanistan. Later, after a couple of years, they invaded Iraq, and they were on both sides of Iran. 38 original U.S. bases, they all encircled Iran, threatening Iran. And it was then that Qasem Soleimani started his mobilization paradigm or formula based on what we had already experienced during the war, Iraqi-imposed war on Iran in the 1980s. And then he embraced success everywhere that he went after this paradigm and formula in Afghanistan, Iraq, and all across the region. Now, after 20 years, where are the Americans? On those days, they were encircling us, and we were inside the borders. Now, our influence and regional might and power has admittedly expanded to the Mediterranean. But where are the Americans? They have been fading away in this region. Now, they have threatened even one of the Iranian allies, Hezbollah, to step back from engaging in the war, in the Israeli war against Gaza. But they stayed unintimidated, and they, you know, started attacks on Israel. They also sent their warships to the Red Sea to threaten the Yemeni nation. Sure. And Yemen's army. But they failed, and as you can see, Yemen continues attacks on Israeli-bound ships, and they have stayed undeterred. So as you can see, these are the products, these groups and allies, they are the products of the efforts made by Haji Qasem Soleimani, the respectable martyr and martyr general. And also, in response to your question, yes, we could still see Haji Qasem Soleimani on the scene pretty well and very much clearly.
Okay. Let's look at what has occurred today in terms of the terrorist incident, Mohammed Marandi. If we were to take a look at the three incidents that have taken place, Sayyid Razi Mousavi, the Iranian military advisor in Syria, and then you have what happened in Beirut in terms of senior Hamas leader Salah Arouri, and then you have what's happened today in the Islamic Republic. Why do you think this occurred? Of course, no matter who has analyzed this, has pointed the finger at Israel being behind it. But what do you think in terms of the timing of it today and after these two targeted assassinations?
The fact that this terror attack today occurred immediately after the terror attack in Beirut and the terror attack in Damascus before it makes people think that it was probably the Israelis that carried out this operation, either alone or with an ally like ISIS, because the Israelis and ISIS cooperated in the dirty war in Syria. ISIS was, they had bases alongside the Golan Heights for years. Their injured militants were treated in Israeli hospitals whenever the Syrian army would try to attack ISIS. Israeli Air Force and artillery would support ISIS. So there is a strong relationship between the two. They tried to bring down the Syrian government along with NATO regimes and regional allies of NATO to break the resistance and create a gap between Iran and its friends in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. And they failed. So it is quite possible that the Israeli regime was behind this. And the reason, obviously, would be that the Israelis are angry. They've lost the war in Gaza. They've lost the military war in Gaza. They've lost the intelligence war in Gaza. And they've destroyed their credibility across the world. And they've destroyed the credibility of the collective West through this genocide, through this Holocaust. So this has been a catastrophic defeat for the regime. So they are angry. But on the other hand, Netanyahu wants to expand the war, because if the war, and he wants to continue the war, because if the war ends, he will be put on trial and he will probably go to jail. So the longer the war, the better it is for Netanyahu. The longer the genocide continues, the better it is for Netanyahu's allies as well. So he has an incentive to continue the war and also to spread the war, because he's losing. And that is how he hopes that the Americans could be brought into the battlefield, which I think is obviously very detrimental to the interests of the United States, because this is not Libya. We're not talking about Iraq, a broken Iraq under Saddam Hussein, a sanctioned Iraq. We're talking about a network of resistance that goes from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean to the Hindu Kush. It is an enormous alliance and the resistance block, mm-hmm. or the resistance axis. And if there's confrontation, obviously, with Iran, it's not a battle that the Americans can win, because Iran could destroy all the facilities in the Persian Gulf. Those countries, if the Americans attack Iran, all those countries that have military bases, American military bases, would be hostile, would be considered as hostile. So their oil and gas installations would be fair game. And in addition to that, that would create a global economic meltdown.
Sure.
And that would be an enormous loss to the United States. So I don't think that the Americans, I have no doubt that the Americans don't want the war to expand.
Okay.
But Netanyahu has a vested interest in expanding the conflict.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Since you mentioned the vast area that the resistance groups cover, I think it's only appropriate that I ask you, Mostafa Khoshesh, about what Iran's leader has said. Maybe you can expand on this further for us, how Haj Qasem Soleimani was instrumental in reviving the resistance front in the region, in the areas that our guests are just mentioned. How did he, was he able to do that?
As I said earlier, when Americans attacked Afghanistan and Iraq, the resistance actually moved to a second stage when, Qasem Soleimani started mobilizing groups and all across the region, especially in a region when we were under threat by the United States, actually, and the other Muslim nations were also under threat. They were being threatened. They were invaded by the United States, and it was clear that the U.S. wanted to, push seven countries all across the region into chaos in compliance with its greater Middle East plan. So this mobilization that was, modeled on Iran's mobilization during the Iraqi post-war started and it expanded, and it could, wreak havoc on Americans everywhere. Now, it's doing the same to the Israelis and Americans everywhere, and as Dr. Marandi said, they know the dire costs of any kind of hostile action against Iran. They realize it in Washington. Although Netanyahu is very much desperate to keep himself in power because he knows the aftermath if the war goes on and without expansion, even if we don't see a ceasefire, many believe now that in about 4 or 5 months, even if the Gaza war continues, Netanyahu will be, brought down from power, and that would be the end of his career. Not just that, but also he will be put behind bars because of his corruption cases and his failure. Uh-huh. You know, his greatest sin, not his sin, but guilt and flaw of the Israeli army and security apparatus, as well as Netanyahu's, guilt and shortcoming, is that the Israeli defense doctrine was shattered in the first 6 hours that Hamas went on attacking them, and they lost all the principles of their military doctrine, and they found themselves surprised and shattered. So these are all the products, what Hamas did, what Hezbollah is doing, what Yemen's army is doing. These are all the products of the model of the move that was started by Martin Soleimani and his efforts and paradigm.
Okay, so still trying to figure out the reasoning that is given when it comes to the genocidal war itself, Mohamed Morandi. Are we looking at Israel seeing this as an existential threat if they don't succeed there in the Gaza Strip? Or is it because they're losing there, they realize it, and therefore they are trying to open up the war in different fronts, like I mentioned about the assassination of Saleh al-Aruri, the Sunni Hamas leader, and Sayyid Razi Mousavi, and of course now what has happened to the Islamic Republic?
I think there are two layers here. One is sheer anger and emotions. The Israelis are very upset, very angry. They're openly talking about genocide, and they're repeating it day after day. You see MPs speaking about genocide, major military commanders speaking about genocide, government ministers. The Israeli president spoke of genocide, the prime minister, Netanyahu, the defense minister. This is the genocidal intent is usually something that even the most evil of regimes hide from the international community. But in the case of Israel, out of sheer despair and anger, they've been saying it day after day. And this is highly detrimental because they're admitting to the world what they're doing. And they are extremely angry towards the Iranians because the capabilities of Hamas in Gaza, the tunnels, what Hamas and its allies, the Islamic Jihad and others have been able to help them defeat the Israeli regime. So there is an emotional component to this in their terror attacks, whether it's against Hamas officials in Lebanon or the Iranian general in Syria, or potentially that if the Israelis were indeed behind it, the terror attack in Kerman. The second layer is, as you pointed out, the Israelis have lost the war. And this, the aura of Israeli invincibility is gone. It took its first blow in 2000 when it retreated from Lebanon. Then the defeat in 2006 was a second blow. But this was a decisive blow, especially since Ansarullah, the Yemeni armed forces, blocked Israeli ports in the south. Hezbollah drew half of its army to the north, and Hamas and its allies were hammering the Israeli armed forces in Gaza. And the Israeli regime, out of sheer anger and racism and rage, was constantly massacring ordinary people. So Israel has destroyed its credibility across the globe. It's shown itself to be genocidal, both in language and words, but in also in action.
Sure.
So the Israelis are in a very bad situation. They're in a very painful and difficult situation. And they need, or at least Netanyahu, both for his selfish interests, as Mr. Khoshkhish rightly pointed out, but also they need the Americans to come in to save the day. And that is not going to help the Israelis. And this proves that the Israeli regime, not only is it detrimental to the interests of the West, its very existence, but also it shows that the Israeli regime is willing to sacrifice its Western allies for its own selfish interests.
That's the key question here then. So what do you think, Mostafa Khoshkhish? When is that red line going to be crossed? We're looking at three different incidents now, almost back to back. If Israel is to continue down this path, are we looking at a massive retaliation? What are we looking at? All the resistance fronts? Some? Iran to be included or not? How do you see this? Were Israel to continue down the path that it is?
How much time are you going to give me about that?
Well, just keep it short. I'm sorry. We're almost reaching the end of the program.
Okay. So let me put it in a nutshell. Okay. First of all, let me add something to my earlier response that General Soleimani, when he did this mobilization program and planning for the Muslim world, for the oppressed Muslim nations, he had, a very good principle that he established. We in Iran, we never look at these allies as proxy forces. That's our difference with others, with the Americans and Israelis, because they use them as, some proxy forces, some terrorists that they hire. But we in Iran look at these groups, as well as the states like Iraq and Syria, as our allies. The difference comes in this, that we do not try to feed them with fish, but we teach them to catch fish. This is different because we look at them as allies, equal allies on equal footing. Now, in response to your questions, definitely I agree with Dr. Marandi that this is, somehow masterminded by Israel or conducted by Israel. And this could have been Israel, or this could have been some terrorist group like Jaish al-Zul, Jaish al-Adl, or ISIS, who have been the plot has been masterminded and done by the Israelis. Definitely, there is no doubt about that. And I do agree that Netanyahu, because of his failures in this war, he wants to escalate the tensions to the region. He wants to bring in the U.S., and he wants to bring the NATO in. But definitely, they will receive a response.
Sure.
Iran has shown on multiple cases, according to the Israelis, whenever they have done something wrong, like assassinating Dr. Fakhrizadeh, the Jerusalem Post reported that the father of their aerospace program, Avi Har-Even, was killed at the heart of Israel. A few months later, when they conducted a sabotage attack at Natanz two times, their main ballistic missile factory offer a lent into the air and experienced explosion. When they started attacking Iranian ships, they said that their own ships, a greater number came under attack. So there are different ways that Iran will definitely provide a response itself and through its allies. Definitely, this is going to happen.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're just fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. Say Mustafa Khoshesh, political analyst. Sorry, we're just fresh out of time. Say Mohammad Morandi, thank you, university professor and political analyst, both from Tehran. With that, we come to the end for this edition of the Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitaly and the team, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was one of the pure fountainheads of knowledge and wisdom. He was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the son of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. And Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam himself was the 10th divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. The ulama and the religious scholars and the fuqaha, the Islamic jurisprudence of the Shia, asked Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam about the different branches of knowledge while he was yet a very young child. And despite his young age, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered all of these great religious scholars and these great religious jurisprudents with the answers of an expert. It was these very answers of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam which made the Shia scholars and Shia jurisprudents and the other leaders of the Shia to believe in the imama of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyara text of Jamaatul Kabira issued by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immat al-huda wa masabih al-tuja wa a'lam al-tuqa wa dawilluha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too.